Sajjad Lone is a man of many paths. He's been a separatist, and he formed his own party. Now he's a minister in the Jammu and Kashmir government, in the coalition government, which also, of course, has the BJP and the PDP. We put several questions to Sajjad Lone on the government's response, the state government's response to the Kashmir unrest, to the Kashmir crisis, and whether there were inherent contradictions between the BJP and the PDP and its allies on which direction to proceed with in both in Kashmir and Pakistan. Sajjad, as a minister in the alliance coalition government here, we are now looking at 41st day of curfew, of lockdown, of unrest. How would you first assess the overall situation?
Well, it's something very regrettable which has happened right from day one. And let me tell you, this is not the first time that this has happened. And this is not something that we've invented in the last 1.5 years. You would know that better than anybody else. In the face of grave provocation, we have tried our best that lives should not be lost. Mm. And regrettably, as I say, they have been lost. But you have to understand that the government is there, has been elected to provide protection to the whole population. Everybody is not on roads. Mm. Still today, 95% people are indoors.
You're saying this is not a mass protest?
Just let me finish this. Is that, well, there is, you know, the definition of a mass protest is relative and varies from numbers, you know, from place to place. But there are huge chunks, 95% is still indoors, who want their children to go to school. You know, somebody who is ill and wants to go to hospital. You know, daily wages who want to do their work, who don't want. But then, when you have grave provocations, kids as young as 12 or 15 want to climb army camps, want to attack police stations. We cannot, as a government, allow this to descend into loot and plunder. That's what it will finally go. It might be something else now. Mm. But a mob mentality is anonymous. No, it's faceless. Mm. So we will have to take steps, and we've been taking steps. And in those grave provocative moments, lives have been lost, which is regrettable. But Parkha, we have not invented it. I repeat it. It has, its roots are long back, you know, they're long back. They don't
belong. There is, of course, a history of errors, of misjudgments by successive governments in Delhi, and we can discuss that philosophically. But when you say this is not the first time we've seen this, Sajjad, as somebody who's been here reporting this story in 2008, in 2010, and now in 2016, I see all three periods of unrest as very different. And to me, this period seems the scariest, because the other two were at least issue-related, right? There was the Amarnath land issue in 2008. There was the injustice and the human rights violations in 2010 as the backdrop. This time we're talking about a slain militant. How do you see the difference between 10 and 16?
Look, 2008, there was an issue. 2010, there were spate of issues. There was the muscle killing. Then there was Tufail
Matus. Yeah.
And then there were some other issues also. And then you had 2010. Out here, as I am telling you, the government had nothing to do with it. There was a young man who apparently must have been popular in some pockets with a gun. And as you know, how much as we would want that it should not happen, you know, we can almost predict the end, that it is going to be violent. Hmm. So government, if we did not go out as in Matsel, after innocent people to kill them, we did not do that.
You see, the government did not make a mistake that led to this.
Yeah, it was totally what has been happening in the last 25 years. There is an insurgency, and forces fight militants. At times, militants kill forces, and at times, forces kill militants.
But why is there popular support for a militant?
It's a trigger, you know, it's a trigger. There could be a trigger.
And don't we need to understand why there are boys on the street in support of a militant?
I'll tell you. You look, go back to Vajpayee era, Mr. Vajpayee. The political process. At that time, Mufti Saab was the chief minister who focused on governance and the political process. Then you had a drought, a political drought of 10 years, which was Congress. No political process and no governance, as is visible in the election figures. Because when you go for elections, we basically seek votes on governance. Mm. There was no governance, no political process. There was a home minister called Chidambaram who started a quiet dialogue, which was conspicuous by the absence of quietitude. And, you know, it just ended in a whimper. Mm. Lot of arrogance.
Whose arrogance? Delhi. The Congress? Chidambaram's? Who in particular?
You see,
who are you calling arrogant in particular?
I am talking about that particular home minister and that particular UPA government.
You're talking about Mr. Chidambaram?
Mr. Chidambaram and the UPA government. Overall,
who in fact says the situation in Kashmir is slipping into chaos?
it's a joke, you know, when it comes from him. Because if I have to go back, rewind my memory a bit, and put up the scripters, the people who scripted the situation today, because it's not today, it's the past. It's a continuous process. He would probably be the first one.
Why?
And so the BP.
Why? Because give a specific reason.
Yeah, because there was a political drought. This day,
he had quiet talks with the Hurriyat conference, which
absence
we now
of
know.
Quietitude, no quiet talks, which were always in the press.
They came
and,
out later.
And which resulted, you have a bedridden separatist today, Mr. Fazal Qureshi. Have you heard of him?
Of course, I've met him several
there.
Times.
He was a victim of that. They had total disdain for talks with Pakistan. They had disdain for talks with Kashmiris. They didn't want to talk to anybody. Mr. Modi made an unscheduled historical visit to Pakistan. He made an attempt. And what did Mr. Manmohan Singh do? Be honest. I'll tell you something personal. On his prodding, I wrote a vision document. Because of which...
Who was prodding?
Mr. Manmohan Singh, when I met him for
Your
talks.
Document was and, called Achievable
and,
Nation.
Yeah, and when I wrote that, because of writing that, my wife is a Pakistani. She was denied visa for 3 years. They didn't know, the right hand did not know what the left hand was doing. And he knew it. There were at least 10 people who went and told him, that why are we doing this to him?
But you know, Fazal, hang on, Sajjad. Fazal Haq Qureshi, if my memory serves me right, was actually involved in the talks that took place on Vajpayee's watch with the Hizbul, with the section of the Hizbul Mujahideen. Chidambaram later meets with the Hurriyat conference. Now, what is the one specific mistake that you're blaming Chidambaram for? Give a specific illustration.
I'm telling you a specific illustration that there was a political drought. They refused to engage. And there was no dignity in any engagement. It was, you know, you could see that the engagement is not credible, that they want to engage for the sake of engagement, not for the sake of any forward movement. And the overall body language was laced with contempt and disdain.
Okay, let's pick up the issues one by one. You said in 2016, unlike in 2010, it's not that the state made mistakes. You know, there were no human rights violations, there were no missteps. But there has been a suggestion from the Congress that the very alliance with the BJP is causing radicalism. This is one argument. You heard Ghulam Nabi Azad stand up in Parliament and say ki log maaf nahi karenge, 200 saal mein bhi aapki alliance ki acceptability nahi hogi. Do you believe that identity issues, as the Congress argues, related to beef politics, hyper-nationalist constructs of what is patriotism, do you believe that that's having a counter-impact here
good,
on the back?
Good you ask this question. See, our problem, Barkha, always has been that whenever there's an opportunity in the most adverse circumstances to get hold of the disease, right, there are these people who come up with the symptoms. Mr. Azad, with all due respect to him, Congress is no angel in Kashmir which has descended from the skies. Their past is very murky. They had the audacity to hang a person, Mr. Afzal Guru, right, in the circumstances and not even give his dead body back. That was the arrogance. Now, when you talk of Congress, when he says that this alliance is not accepted, what happened in 2008? BJP was not there. What happened in 2010? BJP was not there. What happened in 1989? BJP was not there. It was Congress there. Mm. So rather than answering for their misdeeds of 20, 30 years, why are you trying to show that the disease belongs to the BJP? I'm not betting for BJP. Let me be very clear. But I'm just telling you that this whole thing of saying that there is that this alliance is not on ideological
or
basis.
Or that radicalism
so
in the valley is related to...
For example, let me speak. What is the difference nationally between BJP and Congress on Kashmir? Is Congress for secession? Are they saying give them Azadi? Are they saying give them autonomy?
No Delhi government. Autonomy was being... No government in Delhi. We all know this
so
by now.
Saying,
is going to be fundamentally different.
So what is Mr. Azad trying to say?
In terms of the constitutional framework
you
being
see,
the outer parameter.
In 2008, I think 62 people got killed. Before that, the PDP resigned, yeah. Right? Then after that, it was governor's rule. There was UPA rule there. 62 people got killed. In 2010, 120 people got killed. Are you telling me or is Mr. Azad telling us that they were children of lesser God since they were... And so Congress had the right to kill them. There is no difference, absolutely no difference.
There is one difference, and that's not related for me as a Kashmir reporter between BJP and Congress. And that difference to me is, boys are out marching for a slain militant. A militant who's a local, a militant who's educated, a militant who was the son of a school headmaster. When I said this, you had, you know, sort of right-wingers saying you're glorifying him. But these are all facts. His father is a headmaster. There is a phenomenon of local educated boys picking up the gun. How do you read this?
First
How do you read Burhan Wani and the mythology around him?
Let's take Burhan Wani. go further a bit. You've checked his background. Who made him a militant? He didn't want to be one. He was made in the year 2001. And I'm not playing politics here. In the time when the Angelic Congress and the Angelic NC were in an alliance.
Why don't you elaborate on what you're
trying to say? I'll tell you. He was with his brother, who was humiliated, beaten up. And that's when he took an oath at the age of 15 to become a militant to avenge his
humiliation. So you're blaming the forces for the creation of Burhan 1?
I'm blaming the government of the time. Forces are under the government of the time. Right? I'm blaming them.
The forces don't ask the government and take a decision on the
ground. They don't. But at the end of the day, the buck stops here, as the show is called. The buck stops with the government. You know, if you are going to pile on everything on us today, we're saying, yeah, it's regrettable. What can we do? We have a government and we have to maintain law and order. So if we are taking it today, then they have to take that they made him the militant. He didn't want to be one.
So you're saying the Congress
and the NC
and the National Conference have to take the responsibility for the creation of Burhan Wani,
yes.
Because during that government was an encounter between Burhan Wani's brother and the security forces that humiliated him.
A purely civilian encounter.
What I mean by encounter is not a military or operational encounter.
I'm not condoning
encounter,
or condemning anybody,
yeah.
But I'm just putting the reality in front of you. Now it's up to you how you view it, whether we as politicians owe some responsibility or answerable for letting Ruse lose a reign of terror. See, Barkha, I've been watching Mr. Omar Abdullah for the last 10, 15 days or 20 days. He's been making statements, occasionally going to Delhi. You know, he's the leader of the opposition, has got a lot of votes. He should be on the streets, you know, with his people. But let Mr. Omar Abdullah know one thing.
Out on the streets with his people doing what?
Well, consoling them the way he's consoling on Twitter. You know, Twitter can't console, you know. But you have to just let me say one thing. Mr. Omar Abdullah cannot have the luxury of coming in and expressing consolation. He has lost it. And I'm not talking of 2010.
Then?
You talk of 87, the rigged elections.
Omar Abdullah was not in politics then.
Oh, come on, it was his father. That's why he was there. Had his father not been there.
But Delhi is responsible for the rigged election.
Yes, Delhi, not Delhi. It was NC and Congress in 87. Then 96, a selection, not an election. To have Mr. Omar Abdullah here, you have had to. There have been many massacres. And now this person has the audacity to speak on such high moral pedestal. You know, one shivers. How can he be so audacious? You know, at least just look back into your past. This is a creation, partly, of what you guys have done. And now you come and become a glorified, trying to shed tears. For what? Are you not involved? You know, where Omar Abdullah is today, he has had to walk over thousands of dead bodies, shot.
Is that a statement you make with responsibility? Thousands of dead bodies? What do you mean by thousands of dead bodies?
87 a trigger for two decades of violence. Why did they have to rig elections, Mr. Congress and Mr. NC? Why? Why is anybody not answering? You see, Barkha, I had a very good friend, a retired top bureaucrat, calling me from Delhi. And the moment I told him, sir, this goes into the past, he got angry. Because when you revisit the past, then you identify the real villains. You know, it's not about 1.5 years, I told you. We have not invented it. The invention is very far rooted, deep far rooted in history. And I'm just trying you to say.
Now let's look at some of the things that Omar Abdullah has actually said. Mm-hmm. Okay, he has demanded a judicial inquiry into the civilian killings. He says the chief minister herself alluded to an excessive use of force in her Independence Day speech. He says that the prime minister speaks about Balochistan and Pakistan but finds no mention of Kashmir in his Independence Day speech. That he in fact links Balochistan to Kashmir by bringing it up at an all-party meeting on Kashmir. Divorcing the history of Jammu and Kashmir, in which there have been many sins of omission and commission, I think, by all players. Looking just at the comments he's made, do you agree? Do you want a judicial? Would your government support a judicial commission of inquiry into the civilian deaths?
I really don't know what the terms of conditions, the legality of a judicial commission are. But I can assure you the entire cabinet, the chief minister, will leave no stone unturned in ensuring that if there is any excessive use of force, and I'm saying it as a cabinet minister, without any provocation, they will be dealt with the most severe
Do you believe that there has been, because it's a very polarized narrative right now. People like me keep saying there's a middle ground, truth is there on both sides, but this country is very polarized on Kashmir right now. Do you as a cabinet minister believe that there has been an excessive use of force, or do you believe the forces have been compelled to use the force they have?
Look, I'll tell you one thing. We don't have, these are Kashmiri policemen.
Oh, I did a story on them yesterday, and they are terrified. I also want to tell you their story. They are terrified right now. They're the most vulnerable right now.
You see, these are Kashmiri policemen, most of them. I don't see them as trigger happy. I don't think they would have retaliated unless there was extreme provocation. But then Umar Abdullah being Umar Abdullah, him having a lot of experience in killings would know better. But as far as I know, I'm...
What do you mean experience in killings?
Well, as
you know,
I told
you, making these statements like he's out there killing people.
I'm not talking of today. This is not the only time people have been killed there.
120 died in 2010 on his government's watch.
Yes, yes.
But he came out and he said that was, I made mistakes in that period. Would you concede that your government has made mistakes, that you all should have spoken much earlier, that the chief minister should be more visible?
So you kill a person and then say, oh, buddy, I'm sorry. Is that Umar Abdullah?
Let's forget Umar Abdullah. This interview is not about him. Okay. You've said what you said about him. I asked you whether you believe there has been an excessive use of force, or do you believe the forces have acted responsibly?
Tell me, Barkha. We are still, the fire is still on. How do we know that what caused the fire? Do you really think that anybody out here in the entire earth knows where whether there was excessive use of force or not? Would we be able, don't you think it would be too early to judge what happened? That on the spur of a moment, within a second, somebody has to react and we'll sit here and it's all across valley and say there was excessive or there was not. Both the statements are unjustified.
What is your assessment so far?
I have no assessment because we have not been able to go out on the streets. As you said, our policemen, they are working 12-hour shifts, 14-hour shifts, and reporting back to duty. I can tell you there is just one instance, which is a body has been exhumed. A local court
Had exonerated the police officer who was charged in Tengpura.
Had issued warrants. He went to Supreme Court. The body was exhumed. And as I can tell you, of this one case, and it does not generalize, that the boy had died of pellets, as was the assertion of the DSP.
But I'm so glad you've come to pellets, because I actually find that, to me personally, the most problematic and disturbing thing right now. Because if you, as you would have, gone to the hospitals, especially a couple of weeks ago in the first aftermath of this unrest, you're seeing people between children, 16, 17, 18, there's a girl in Shah, she's 14, right? Partially or permanently blinded in some cases. And you have the CRPF DG who just now on this program has said that, look, we don't have, this is the best option of bad options. How do you see the pellet guns debate?
It's heartbreaking to see young kids losing their sight in both eyes or in one eye. This can be, you know, it's worse than death. But Barkha, try to understand, we are a civilian government. We are not security experts. Neither was the last government. These security experts of the time, in 2010, advised the government of the day that pellet guns are a non-lethal weapon. They, on the advice of the security experts, bought around 1,000 pellet guns. Mm. And we never knew that, we never anticipated there is going to be a law and order problem. A law and order problem unexpectedly erupted at a massive scale. We took these guns in the belief that they are non-lethal and used them. And now as I talk to you, we find them as a lesser evil. It's a very, very heartless statement to say between killing them and using...
But between killing them and blinding them, doesn't it erode moral authority? I'm not saying anyone's out to deliberately blind anyone. I just want to clarify that. But that's the result or the consequence.
Even in that, the protocol to be followed is strict, that it has to be fired at a certain distance and at a certain
height, below the waist.
Below the waist, right?
That's not happening because the nature of the gun is it splatters pellets into the air.
After it has been put into focus, that's what is being used, and we are trying to minimize the use as much as possible. But I can assure you that the moment we are relatively in a period of calm, the government will leave no efforts. We'll go across the world and now try to seek the advice of security experts in a larger ambit and see and ensure that any crowd control tools that we purchase for future are totally non-lethal.
You don't want an immediate ban on them?
Well, you see, we have to choose between two options, unfortunately. And I can tell you we've minimized them. as much as is possible.
Tell
and,
me a little
and,
bit.
And strict orders have been issued right from the top from the chief minister that they should not in any way venture near the eye. Fire them in a manner that you've been, that's professionally advised to.
Okay, now the nature of the gun actually makes that a bit difficult, but it's with the committee right now that's reviewing its use. As somebody who has been a separatist, who's had a very, very eventful journey from being a separatist into mainstream electoral politics, Sajjad, and I think I followed you from that moment till now. How do you read the boys who are out on the street? How do you understand their psychology, their backgrounds? Who are they for you? Is there a pattern, something that unites them, these young men out on the streets protesting?
Well, I feel sad, you know. You know, when I was a young boy and my father would tell me, don't do it, I would tell him, let me experience it. Why are you thrusting your opinion on me? Some things he said were probably not in the new scheme of things, were out of tune with time. But there are many things that I listened to him as a young boy. The pain that I had to endure in my journey as a student, going abroad and doing business, would have been lessened to a great extent. I cannot force my opinion on these young boys, but I wish I could show them from the core of my heart that there is a lot of pain in what they are doing. And it will only attract more pain and more pain.
And the cycle will keep
feeding
itself.
That an entire generation has gone through this pain. I just pray to my Allah that good sense, whatever it is, I will not be judgmental in any way, prevails on these young kids. Because God forbid, if they go on this journey, it's a painful journey, full of pain. And that's all I can tell them. Because even in my moments as a separatist, I never condoned violence. Barka, one thing is there. If something is bad for my children, it's bad for all children. If I don't allow my children to pelt stones, and this is a statement I have made even when I was a separatist, how can I tell the neighbor's child to go and pelt stones? If you look at the pattern of deaths, the families, we did a small survey, which by no means is official. 98%, apart from one, belong to BPL families, below poverty line families. I have one thing to ask on your program today. Where are those Twitter wallahs and Facebook wallahs? Such jingoism exhibited on the Twitter, on the Facebook, you know, which can incite anybody. I'm not saying may Allah give them a long life, but not one is there on the streets. Why are they pushing a particular class towards these killing fields?
You're saying
why?
Militants and separatists and extremists are pushing out only the poor or the
about,
poorer boys out on the street?
I talked about the social media activists. As far as the separatists are concerned, somebody else is concerned, they also have young children at home, but they are not on streets. And that's a reality. I know they will not like it when I say, but that is a reality, that their young children are not on the streets. They are in their homes.
I do have to ask you in the end, there's a lot of debate about the Pakistan dimension here. And, you know, you have some people who believe that the Pakistan emphasis is what's driving this, that Pakistan's fueling trouble, that there's money channeled into bank accounts, the NIA is now investigating it. How do you see Pakistan's role in this?
Well, look, I'll tell you, nothing is spontaneous in Kashmir.
Nothing is spontaneous.
Yeah, nothing.
So you're saying these protests are not spontaneous?
Nothing is spontaneous in Kashmir. And I can talk for the last 2.5 decades since this has started. Now take our government. We came in then Handwara. What was Handwara? Where was the molestation? Right? We barely tried to suppress it. Not suppress it, allowed people to vent their anger. Suppress is the wrong word. And I remember, you know, NDTV at that time, you tried to flare it up as much
as
possible.
No, we didn't. Why would we try to flare up anything?
But we were, you know, your correspondent, I told him really okay in 2 days. But then, you know, the picture was different.
Mm.
But thank God it was there. But, you see, Pakistan has had a historical role.
An army bunker did come down in Handwara for the sake of peace.
Yeah, we did it.
Yeah, so I'm just saying, you know, it's not the channels can create flare-ups. It was a serious situation on the ground.
The government did it.
And in the end, peace was bought with you. You were also there when that bunker came down.
I was not also, I was there.
I mean, you were driving that. I'm saying you were driving that.
The point is that it was a structural intervention by the government. And the army appreciated it. Everybody, you see, you can't have a bunkered coexistence with the Kashmiris. It has to be bunkerless.
But come back to your point that nothing is spontaneous on the Pakistan point.
I'm saying nothing is spontaneous. Pakistan has always been a party in whatever is happening here. But one thing is clear, that their terrorist cannot be our hero. If terrorism is bad there, it's bad here. It's like a terrorist, for example, being pursued by the Pakistani security forces. He's running, they're running after him. And if he crosses the border, now he's a mujahid. It can't happen. You can't be so selective. And forget Kashmir, we'll take care of ourselves, this is our land. For the sake of Pakistan, I've never been somebody who wished bad for them. You know, my family is 50%.
I mean, you're married to a Pakistani,
But, you know, if there is a poison which is going to, you know, which they might use it there, the poison is going to be poison there also. But then it's up to them, you know. We can't, you know, I can't be judgmental and say they're doing this, they're doing... I don't have any information about whether they're bankrolling somebody or whether they're not bankrolling. But, yes, they've had a role historically in what is happening here. And they have a controlling, you know...
Interest.
Influence on the separatists also, which is a reality and which even the separatists don't hide. I would if I had, but they don't.
One last question. One of the contradictions of this alliance seems to be that the government in Delhi has gone now very hard on Pakistan. I agree, after attempts made by Prime Minister Modi with Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif in Pakistan. However, now you have the Foreign Secretary saying terrorism is at the centrality of this relationship between India and Pakistan. But Chief Minister Mehbooba Mufti and the agenda of alliance again and again and again is talking about friendly relations with Pakistan. How will you resolve this contradiction with the BJP and the policy position is taken on Pakistan?
No, no, there is no issue. You see, government is multi-dimensional. There is a foreign affairs ministry in Delhi. We don't have a foreign affairs ministry in Kashmir, which deals with relationships with Pakistan. And had the BJP and the PDP or this alliance overlapped on everything, had there been a total political overlap or an ideological overlap, there would not have been two parties. There would have been only one party.
Yeah.
But there are political, structural, social... differences, subtle differences. And I don't, first of all, I don't see there's a huge gulf. You know, Prime Minister Modi did go out to...
I'm talking about now.
Look, nothing is static. You have seen eyeball-to-eyeball controversy, followed by talks, followed by Lahore.
Yeah.
Nothing is permanent. Eventually, you know, whatever happens, eventually, one day there are going to be talks.
Yeah.
Whenever it is, whenever sense is driven into them.
Yeah.
But then, you know, I... would not think it's, you know, it's prudent to actually comment on something which is in the domain of the foreign ministry.
Okay.
Which the prime minister thinks what he's doing there, they have a different sets of information or different sets of information, their own systems. You know, we sitting here are battling a law and order problem, but our whole overall this thing is that yes, engagement, inclusive engagement is an imperative. And I'm talking of Kashmiris, you know, as far as I'm concerned, that we need to engage everybody in a realistic manner. But at the same time, you can't have two people at the same table. One party can't have two representatives. Now take separatists. If they tow a Kashmiri line, you know, the engagement will be constructive.
Yeah.
But if they parrot somebody else's line, then there is better to talk to the parrot rather than them, you know.
All right, so you're talking about parroting a Pakistani line. We leave it there. Sajjad Lone, provocative as ever. Thank you so much for being on the Buck Stops here.
Thank you.